Because television presents information on which we don't have to work creatively. We just process the visual stimuli that we see, and we don't have to either decode the information as we do when we read, which is a much more active activity, and we don't have to do anything creative to organize the information we are presented with. We have to only passively absorb it. So generally, as one watches TV, one tends to feel worse and worse the more one watches it. Instead of feeling better, you tend to feel worse. Now, it's also true, though, that you can watch TV in an active mode, in a more creative mode. And the way to do it is, like with every other flow activity, you have to set a goal. For instance, you have to know what programs you want to watch and why you're watching it. So you choose, and you don't randomly have your attention captured by whatever is on the screen. As long as you have a goal and you set yourself up to watch this particular program, then you can also become more involved in it by using skills in looking at what you are watching in a way that it becomes an interactive process. That is, you are critically watching. You are, suppose, for instance, that you're watching a drama on PBS, or you're even watching a police serial on one of the main channels. You can watch that critically. That is, you set up certain expectations. You wonder what is going to happen. You look at whether the actors or the screenwriter is doing his job well. And you are not just uncritically following what you're doing, but you are letting your mind interact with the material in a more active and creative way. So what we find actually in research is that people who watch television in this way get out of it a much better quality of experience. They enjoy it more and they learn more from it. TV becomes a waste of time when you watch it in complete passivity, and then the quality of experience deteriorates and you don't learn anything from it. So the way to cope with solitude is to take an active role, and if you do program your time and you develop goals and you use your skills, then solitude can become the best part of your day, something to look forward to instead of avoiding. And the people who look at solitude like that actually find that that is an opportunity for enjoyment and growth instead of something to be dreaded and avoided as much as possible. If you don't know how to cope with solitude, then you will be scared to be alone, and you will be looking for anything that will take your mind off the kind of chaos that comes to consciousness when we don't have a goal. And often, in order to avoid this solitude, they get involved in relationships that are destructive. They end up getting involved in activities that are dangerous, like gambling or the use of drugs. Anything to get away from the dreaded loneliness that awaits them. But on the other hand, if you have the skills, if you know how to use this amazing opportunity that we have when we are alone with nothing to do, then this can become a part of life which is incredibly enriching. But being alone is not the only opportunity that many of us miss or waste. The other one is what comes with family life, with the kind of interaction we have with people who are close to us.
Flow and the family.
Unfortunately, many people believe that once they are married and have children, then their home life is secure and they need no longer invest any effort in it. So after work, they come back to a warm home where everyone is happy and contented. This is what people assume that happens after marriage. But unfortunately, it does not. If you just come home from work hoping that everything will be harmonious and serene at home, you are probably in for an unpleasant surprise. working with executives who are in their 40s, late 40s and 50s, one of the things that I have to deal with over and over again is the feeling of surprise and resentment that many of these people have about the fact that their families are breaking up, that they come home and there's no one at home. The children are doing something that is off on their own. The wives have developed their own interests and they're no longer interested in staying in a home where there is no input of emotion and intelligence from their husbands. These men, who may be very successful at their jobs, tend to feel suddenly deprived of the security and comfort that they expected would be theirs in their family life. And now, in many cases, it's too late to do anything about it. What they have missed, these people, during the last 20 years, is the realization that family life can be incredibly enjoyable and satisfying and rewarding if you take the time and if you take the energy that you need to invest in it. A family won't grow by itself, just as a business or a corporation won't grow, unless there is attention, psychic energy invested in it, unless people are motivated to work in it. And similarly, a family cannot survive out of good intentions, out of love, unless you invest energy, attention in it. We think now that quality time is what counts, but quality packaged into 5 minutes of interaction does not work. There is no quality that can carry through in 5 minutes. We need a lot of time to understand what our children want. We have to realize what their goals are. We have to realize what their dreams are. We have to know what their skills are. And we have to help them to match these dreams and the skills with opportunities that we help them recognize and create. We have to know how to transfer to them the vision, the dreams that we have in our life so that they have something to follow. And the same with our spouses. We have to realize that relationships change with time and needs change with time. We have to discover what are the things we can do with our spouse that are fun at age 35, 40, 45, 50. And what is fun, what is possible, what is enjoyable will change. The interest of our spouses will change. And unless we keep abreast of what's happening in the family, unless we pay attention to see what are the new things that we can do that will be enjoyable, the family is going to disintegrate. And then at age 50 or so, we'll find ourselves alone. And those whom we loved, but we did not take the care to invest attention in, will have gone on their own way. And that is a lot of what happens to people who miss the fact that relationships need the kind of tender, loving care that any other human activity, like a business job, requires. And if we don't learn how to make the family life enjoyable for everyone, then the family will not keep together. Now, there is a lot of compromise we have to learn because maybe, you know, your wife likes to go to the opera or to an auction, an antique auction, and you like to go and watch car racing or motocross, or you like to go fishing. And left to themselves, these natural interests will pull you apart unless you learn how to compromise and go to an antique auction one weekend and go fishing together the other weekend, so that you learn why the other person likes what they are doing, what kind of skills they have in doing what they enjoy doing, and you learn some of those skills yourself so that you can begin to enjoy these different activities. And of course, if you have children, as teenagers, their interests are bound to diverge from that of their parents, and you have to let them go their way. But at the same time, you can keep things together, family traditions that are enjoyable, that they will still like, and if they quit for a few years, they will be glad to return to later on. Family traditions like vacations in certain parts of the country where you can all learn and do things together, or common activities of going seeing things together that you can do, or activities such as decorating Christmas trees or observing holidays or family things together where you cook and eat and do things in ways that are unique to your family, which you will remember as being part of what gave your family joy and allowed every member of the family to participate. So these little things, these things that require forethought, require developing certain skills, developing goals, makes the family continue to go together. Of course, women are still better at finding flow in the family than men. Here are, for example, some of the things women told us that they enjoyed most in their lives. For instance, one of them said,
"Oh, yes, when I'm working with my daughter, when she's discovering something new, a new cookie recipe that she has accomplished, that she has made herself, an artistic work she's done that she's proud of. Her reading is one thing that she's really into, and we read together. She reads to me, and I read to her. And that's a time when I sort of lose touch with the rest of the world. I'm totally absorbed in what I'm doing."
But this type of delicate, almost artistic interaction with children is not just women's work. It is essential for men to be involved in such enjoyable activities with their sons and daughters also. A good example would be what was shown in the recent movie A River Runs Through It, where the greatest moments in the lives of their sons were going out fishing with their father. Unless you enjoy doing complex things together with the family, it will soon become boring, and the children will drift away and marriages will crumble.
Flow and friendship.
One of the most important experiences in our lives are friendships. When we do our studies of everyday life using the pagers, we find that everything people do together with friends becomes much more enjoyable than when you do it alone. Whether it's eating a meal or going shopping or driving a car or just having a conversation, the quality of experience goes up tremendously. In fact, we find that people enjoy their friends more on the whole than they enjoy their spouse, children. The family, most people feel that is something given, something to be endured, but not something to be enjoyed, whereas friendships are always more positive. Now, I don't think this needs to happen like this. I think the family can be much more enjoyable if we learn how to make it so. But in present time, I must say that friends are generally experienced as being more enjoyable, that we can get a higher quality of life when we are with our friends than when we are with anyone else. This is true even of older people. Studies done with senior citizens who were in retirement homes found that even at age 80, you enjoy the company of friends more than you enjoy the company of your family. Now, given the fact that friends are so important, it's really very sad to realize how few friends most people have. Compared to almost any other culture in the United States, we tend to have fewer friends as adults than it's true in other cultures. This is, in a way, natural because we enjoy a much greater mobility geographically. We move from one part of the country to the other. We move from one job to the other and from one part of the world to the other much more frequently than anyone ever moved before in any other historical period. Now, on the other hand, we have to pay a price for this great mobility. The price we pay is that we cut our ties to people, we cut our ties to communities much more abruptly than anyone else did before. And the price we pay is that in adulthood we have few friends, and this makes life poorer to a great extent. We have to learn to cultivate our friends. Our friends will not continue to exist unless we devote energy to them. Like everything else, any relationship, any activity, We have to invest psychic energy. We have to pay attention to them. We have to keep up with them, call them, write to them if we want to keep up our friendship. That's the problem we have so often with other people, is that we treat them simply as tools. We only pay attention to them because we want something out of them for our sake. So we treat them as dispensable commodities, not as individuals who are interesting and important for their own sake. But if you take the first step and you invest some of yourself in the relationship, and it's really like an investment, and it's risky, like any investment is risky, you're putting something up that can be ignored, rejected, or exploited in turn, and you have to take that risk.
How to create flow with others.
Like any other type of interaction, you can have flow with other people when you have a common goal, when you are interacting with these people towards that goal, where your skills are matched with the skills of the other person, and out of the interaction something new comes up. Think, for instance, about jazz improvisation group, okay? You hear these instruments, the cornet and the saxophone and the guitar or whatever, playing with each other, proposing a theme, the other instrument takes it up and embellishes on it, and then the theme is repeated and it's played with in different keys, in different tempos. That kind of improvisation is what a relationship is about, a conversation, an interaction. You say that you want to go to the movie, the other person says, well, what movie should we look at? You negotiate, you state your interest, and then you settle on going to the movie or not. You may go to the beach instead or to a restaurant. But the point is that you develop a goal together by stating your interest and by communicating to each other what your preferences are, and then settling on a common goal. And then as you go, as you are there, you keep exchanging ideas, you keep exchanging emotions, feelings. And as you work these together, you are both stimulating the other person to think deeper or feel deeper about their own experience, and you learn by sharing these thoughts and experiences with the other person. So it becomes an interactive action that is enjoyable and growth-producing. Now, this can happen in any situation, and it can be among friends, among lovers, among family members. The important thing is that the communication of ideas, thoughts, experiences get shared and are stimulating to each other. One example of how you can turn even a potentially very threatening interaction into something positive and growth-producing occurred when our son Mark, at age 12, returning from school, had been accosted by three young men who were obviously in kind of a desperate situation. My son was walking through the park. He took a shortcut from school and walked in this rather solitary path through the park. And these three men stopped him and told him that they were going to take away whatever he had on him, and if he screamed or ran or resisted in any way, they would shoot him. And one of them had a gun in his pocket, and the others were saying, "You're going to get shot if you don't give us immediately what you have." So Mark had no more than a quarter in his pocket, but he also had a watch, and so they took the quarter and they took the watch. And they told him to walk towards home without turning, without saying anything, and they walked in the opposite direction. Well, apparently Mark walked two or three steps towards home, and then he turned around and said, "Hey guys, could you wait a minute?" And they said, "No, no, go, be quiet or we'll shoot." And he said, listen, what I want to tell you is that that watch you took was given to me by my mother for my birthday 2 years ago. It's not worth anything to you. It's an old watch. It's almost broke. But to me, it means a lot because it was given for my birthday by my mother." And so the guys kept hushing him and trying to push him away, but finally he was so insistent that they decided to take a vote whether to shoot him or to give him back the watch. And the vote ended up being 2-1 for returning the watch. And so he took the watch and walked home and was very proud. He told us what happened. And of course, my wife and I almost fainted and told him why he had been so foolish to expose his life for the sake of the watch. After all, this man could have been on drugs or desperate and could have shot him. But innocent as he was at the time, he said, well, I thought that if I explained to these people why this watch was important, they would realize it and they would not harm me for it. Well, he was lucky. I certainly don't recommend this as a solution to similar situations. But what I think the story illustrates is that relationships or interactions, even interactions of this type, can be changed if you treat people not as robbers in this case, not as people you detest or you mistrust, but as reasonable human beings who share your feelings, you communicate your feelings, you explain your feelings, and very often you get a response that matches your response. It's not that everybody's out there to take advantage of you. There are people like that. But it's amazing how often you can establish a relationship, an interaction, which is smooth and meaningful and rewarding and even enjoyable if you take the trouble to treat other people as partners, as shared members of a community, rather than opponents or competitors or people that you have to use rather than enjoy the company of.
Flow and strangers.
It's not only relationship with family, friends that can enrich one's life, but paradoxically enough, it may be the way you treat strangers, the way you deal with people you don't know, that can also make a big difference in the quality of your experience. For instance, you probably know that in France, Italy, in many countries, Spain, people spend a great amount of time sitting at tables, outdoor cafes, watching the parade of people walking up and down. And the reason that is such an enjoyable thing for these people, in fact, that's the thing they look mostly forward in their day, is to be able to do this. The reason it's so enjoyable is because as you look at each person passing by, you don't know these people, but you can imagine what they are doing, what their life is like, who their friends are, what their profession is, whether they are happy or not, and if so, why, whether they have affairs, whether they are faithful to their husbands or wives. All of these questions you can match up with the people and with their physiognomy, with the way they walk, with their expressions and so forth. And this is highly enjoyable. It's like watching a movie in which you are writing your own script. You are casting your own characters. Looking around, looking at the people, imagining, creating little stories about what they are and who they are and what they are doing can be a way of passing time which is enjoyable and actually contributes to developing certain skills. The skill of recognizing, characterizing people, of empathizing, of learning to feel the way other people feel, which is important in any real relationship or in any business transaction. So this is not a waste of time, and it's a way of filling time that otherwise would be wasted with something which is enjoyable and potentially growth producing. Who we are with makes a big difference to the quality of our lives. For someone who has not learned to control consciousness, loneliness is frightening, and the company of other people is often threatening or boring. But if you have developed an autotelic personality, you are no longer at the mercy of your surroundings. Having mastered flow in solitude and in company, you need no longer feel lonely when you are alone, and you can transform routine and even painful interactions with others into enjoyable experiences. Instead of letting your social surroundings determine whether to feel happy or not, It is you who will be in charge.
A woman describes her feelings of extreme involvement and pleasure as she shares her skills and experiences of success with her children.
I try to involve my children in my work, especially my older daughter, who's been coming to the office and working with me. There are frequently times when we are home or driving around and talking about my work or something like that. There's sort of a sense of joy and accomplishment in what I'm doing, and I'm able to bring them into it also.
By creating flow experiences throughout our life, we learn to lead lives of constant fulfillment. Professor Csikszentmihalyi explains how you can make this ideal possible.
A few years ago, I received a letter from a reader who was at that time in his mid-80s. He wrote that when he read my book Flow, he immediately recognized the experience. It was what he had felt as a young man in the army over 60 years earlier, when he and his fellows in the field artillery used to unhitch the horses from the guns and ride them to play polo. It had been such an exhilarating experience. Nothing else afterwards came close. But after reading the book, the man wrote, he realized that what he felt playing polo may not be unique, and there could be other ways to get the same joyful feeling. He tried to do a few new things suggested in the book, and lo and behold, he found that they were also lots of fun. He concluded the letter thanking me for the revelation. I was, of course, very pleased that the old gentleman had improved the quality of his life, but I was also saddened to think of all the opportunities he had missed in the 60 years in between. Yet, there are many people out there who experience flow once or twice, perhaps in a game or in a love affair, and then spend the rest of their years thinking back with nostalgia at that high point in their lives. One of Leo Tolstoy's best short novels describes such a person. The character of the story is Ivan Illich, a respected judge in the Russia of the Tsars. Ivan is ill, lying in bed, racked by constant pain. Actually, he's dying, although no one, least of all Ivan, wants to admit it. Reduced to helplessness, Ivan is forced to think back on his past, and he realizes with horror that it had all been wasted. For as far back as he can remember, he always did what others expected him to do, never what he felt like doing. He studied, gambled, made love, made friends, climbed the steps of his career, because this was what everybody else seemed to think he should do. He became rich and successful, but he never had a close friend, a true love, or an hour of true enjoyment. Just before dying, a memory from childhood bursts into Ivan's consciousness. He is perhaps 6 or 7 years old, running through a field of flowers with the wind in his hair, the sun shining, the birds singing. It is the only happy moment he can recall from the dreary years of his long life. All too often, the story of Ivan Illich is also the story of many of our lives. As children, we are able to find flow in almost anything we do spontaneously. A child enjoys at first just moving their fingers, moving their limbs, learning to walk. Each one of these is a challenge that requires the full concentration, that requires developing, stretching our abilities to the utmost. And after that, learning a language, learning to read, all of these activities that we develop spontaneously but with certain difficulty as we grow up, this keeps us fully in flow. Just building a house of blocks or learning to ride a bicycle, all of these are sources of enjoyment. As children, we learn to pay attention, to focus, to make goals, to balance our challenges and skills, to constantly readjust them. And in a normal childhood, this process of enjoyable growth is normal. The child doesn't have to be privileged to experience joy as he or she grows up. But unfortunately, too many of these joyful children turn into surly teenagers or dispirited adults and bitter old people. The life cycle from early childhood to old age provides distinctly different opportunities for enjoyment. From the physical activity of youth to the reflective introspection of the elderly, each season of a person's life has its own particular strength.
Flow and childhood.
It is as important to know how to enrich the lives of our children, our teenagers, as it is to prepare ourselves for the years ahead. Psychologists such as Jean Piaget and Erik Erikson have studied how we grow from infancy and childhood through the life cycle and develop constantly new opportunities for action. Now, many of us never take those opportunities, but they are there and they open up at different times in a schedule, in a sequence that is possible to see when you study what happens to people as they grow up. For instance, in infancy and childhood, Piaget has shown us that we interact with the environment through sensory motor channels. That is, everything we learn from the environment is through our senses and through the movement of our bodies. And it's here, through the movement of bodies, through physical movement, games, wordplay, puzzles, that we learn to interact with the environment. And in a normal childhood, the opportunities for such involvement are there. Unfortunately, not all children grow up in normal environments. They may have either no stimulation at all or too much of it. But if we can then graduate from this early sensory motor development into more skillful uses of our body, and this comes as fine motor coordination develops by third, fourth year, our children can begin to learn how to use music, how to use drawing as ways of expressing and developing their body and their mind. Later, around age 4 or 5, reading and telling of stories and the kind of symbolic representation of the world becomes possible, and then that opens up a whole new realm of flow experiences. At the same time, as the skills of the child develop, we have to also provide enough security and enough love for them so that they can develop enough self-confidence so that flow can become easy and spontaneous, so that they don't grow up defensive, they don't grow up worried, they don't grow up feeling that they can't do anything in the world, that they are inferior, and so forth. If the conditions are not too good at this time, the child can become too shy, introspective, not sure enough, or on the other hand, the child becomes hyperactive. It needs so high levels of stimulation that everything else seems boring, and only the risky, aggressive, hyperactive behavior can register on the nervous system of the child. Now, this, of course, can have chemical origins, often has chemical origins, but it's often aggravated also by the environment in which the child grows up. Now, in an optimal environment where the child has security and harmony and love on the one hand and stimulation and enrichment on the other, then the child is always in flow. It's always doing something new, always learning, having new interests. Unfortunately, this natural way of growing up and enjoying the process of growing is often stopped the moment the child enters schools. The moment the child begins to be in school, he or she can no longer set goals, cannot match challenges with skills at the level that's optimal. Instead, the child has to be sitting in a confined environment and pay attention to goals that they have no choice over. The goals in the classroom are chosen by educational bureaucracy and finally filtered down to the teacher. So the child doesn't know why he or she does what is just doing. There's the goals are not clear. The feedback is not clear. It's a very unnatural environment for a child. Instead of exploring and following their interests, they have to comply with the requirements of adult world, which they don't understand. So for many children, the spontaneous flow that is a birthright of all human beings ends all too soon once they enter school. Now, luckily, there are others, and a good number of them, who find the challenges of the academic assignments enough to feel that they are growing, that they are learning, they are developing skills, self-confidence. If they can't find the challenges of the academic environment that matches their skills, what happens is an increase in low self-esteem, an increase in boredom, and a general apathy, a kind of lack of interest, a lack of joy in their activities. So they come home tired and bored, and it seems like they have been put essentially almost into some kind of zombie-like state. An example of how difficult it is to find enjoyment in school is the example of my son Mark, who was very gifted academically. He ended up going to Harvard and Stanford and getting a PhD in Chinese. But when he was in fifth grade, I remember asking him at the end of the year what was the most enjoyable moment he remembered of the 9 months he had been in school in fifth grade. And he thought about it, and finally he said, well, it was when my teacher collected the milk money from the class and then gave me this money to take up to the principal, and I had to go out of the classroom, I had to walk down the hall, up the stairs, down the other stairs, and with all this money in my pocket, all the money was probably $5 at the most. But to him, this feeling of responsibility, of challenge, of a goal that was clear to him, he had to navigate, find his way, go to the principal, give him the money. This was the most exciting thing that happened in 9 months of school. Now, this child who was gifted in many ways and had a good academic preparation, but even for him, there was not enough in the schools to get engaged, to get involved. And this is one of the problems I think we have in our culture, is that we don't know how to engage young people in activities that are meaningful to them, that are challenging enough. We think that just because we as adults decide they have to do these things, they will do it somehow. And maybe they will do it, but in the process they will forget the ability. They will have grown out of the ability to structure their own life, to set goals, to enjoy the use of their skills in a situation that is under their control. And somehow, I think this is one of the problems that then we reap the fruits of when the children grow up into adults who are not really interested in their jobs and end up in a life that is not very satisfying to them.
Flow and adolescence.
In the teenage years, in adolescence, a whole new set of opportunities for action presents themselves to a child. Here, the puberty brings in the whole new hormonal desires that start at that time and that begin adult sexuality. So, at this point, friendships, running risk, trying one's limits, discovering who one is, and building a self become the major goals of a growing person. Unless there are opportunities for friendship, for making friendships, for engaging in relationships, for demonstrating who one is by doing serious things, by occasionally taking risks, by exposing oneself to failure, but pushing a little bit of the envelope until one knows who one is, by trying as hard as possible to get to the limits of one's abilities. Unless one has these opportunities, it's very difficult to enjoy these teenage years. The reason we have so many discontented and apathetic adolescents is because we don't create environments for them where they can do these things. We have these huge suburban developments where one bedroom next to the other with a few shopping malls, and occasionally there's an athletic field thrown in where at least you can do some sports as a young man and find out who you are, what you can do. But more than that, it's a very sterile environment. There is not that much you can try. There's not that much you can do. So as a teenager, you essentially have very few avenues for exploring your identity. There is the school where you can do academic things, you can do some athletic stuff, you can hang out at the mall, but serious stuff is very difficult to explore, serious activities that really test your skills. In fact, in this age, probably the best things that we offer teenagers are the extracurricular activities in school, where they can learn to put together a newspaper or put on a play or play in a band. These extracurriculars teach skills, they teach discipline, they challenge a student to do their best. But unfortunately, in many schools, these activities, these extracurricular activities, are the first ones to get the axe when there's a budget crunch. You disband the band, you abolish art, you take away these opportunities that more than anything else keep teenagers feeling that they are growing, that they are learning and growing something that they want to do.
Flow and adulthood.
After the time of adolescence, when we discover who we are, when develop our identity, the next stage of life, according to Erik Erikson, who has studied how people grow and what challenges they face as they grow older, the next stage of life is one that is called intimacy. And this is the time when, after having more or less found out who we are by testing our limits, by trying different things, we are now ready to share with another person, to come closer to another person and learn through relationships rather than learning through activities, through doing things. Now we are sharing, and that's how we grow, through intimacy. Often this means developing a permanent romantic relationship or a permanent marriage or other form in which intimacy can be established and reinforced. But even if not in that form, it's very important for a person to learn to get out of oneself, to learn the joys of sharing, sharing ideas, sharing feelings, sharing activities with someone else. If one doesn't learn that intimacy, the possibilities of sharing, it's very easy to become power hungry, to become an overachiever, somebody who is so wrapped up in himself or herself that the only thing that counts is the successes, material successes that one accomplishes. And that exclusive focus with material success becomes an obstacle, a hindrance to experience flow in many other areas of life that can be enriching, that can be very important.
Flow and middle age.
The next stage of life, which usually begins in one's mid-30s and continues even to the late 50s, is a stage that Erikson called one of generativity. Generativity is, in addition to sharing, it involves the passing on of one's values, one's ideas, one's identity to a new generation, to younger people. As the name generativity implies, this can be done in a physiological way, that passing on one's genes. After all, one's genes have the blueprint of one's temperament, of one's identity, and passing them on in children is one way of continuing one's being, of transmitting one's being to a next generation. But that's not the only way to be generative. It's possible to reproduce, instead of one's genes, to reproduce one's ideas, one's feelings, one's experiences. And that's why it is at this point, mid-30s to mid-50s, that the best mentors are made. Mentoring is one way to be generative, helping younger people, helping others to learn one's knowledge, learn one's values, and in that sense continue what's important to us in this life for the next generation. This is the time when being concerned with permanence, with transmission of values, one can become a leader. It is the time of life when other younger people begin to look up to one because of one's experience. And leadership and helping others, being generative, being a mentor, being a father or a mother, open up a whole new realm of opportunities. And if one develops the skills to match, then being generative is a whole new flow opportunity that is rare in earlier life. Now you can do it because it's the time of your life to be generative. It's the time when you have enough experience, you have enough knowledge, and you have clarified your own values enough so you can begin to pass them on. If you don't take on this opportunity, it's easy to become cynical. It's easy to feel that, well, the world ends with you. There's nothing after you, nothing interesting is going to happen. So people who become cynical end up enjoying disrupting other people, disrupting institutions, disrupting for the sake of disinterest or actually feel that, well, it's not worth much what happens once you pass on. Whereas if you learn to be generative, then you have a stake in the future. You think that what happens in the future will be important and you can work towards it.
Flow and the later years.
Finally, the last stage of life, according to Erickson, is one of integrity. Integrity describes the attempt to make a whole of one's life. The word integrity comes from the Latin word for wholeness, for something which is together. Now you have a chance to reflect on what happened, to understand what went on in your life, what the meaning of the events that you experienced, the meaning of the relationship you had. And now is the time to, as a result of your reflections, to become somewhat wise. That is, to interpret, connect, explain to yourself what happened, accept what happened, and enjoy the memory of your life and enjoy the ability now of seeing what is the thread, what is that kept your life together, what made it the kind of life it was. And if you don't achieve this integration of your past into your present, it's easy to fall into the opposite state of despair, of feeling that it was all wasted or it was all meaningless, it didn't make any sense. And people who are this in the later part of their life fall into this sense of despair, they typically lack enjoyment in what they do. They don't feel that anything is worth doing, and they kind of decline in a state of increasing detachment from life, increasing bitterness about themselves and their past and the lack of outlook in the future. Of course, the integrity that is the major task of old age is not the only opportunity for action for old people. In fact, it's amazing how many new opportunities there are for action, for learning new skills in old age, partly because you don't have the pressures anymore that you had earlier for making a living, for bringing up a family, being responsible for children, etc. It's amazing what you find people doing once they retired, if they have developed the skills to control their consciousness, to develop new skills. For instance, a good example would be a friend of mine who is a very famous physicist, Two of his students became Nobel Prize winners, and he almost got one himself, which he refused in order to give it to a younger student of him who he claimed had more to do with the discovery than him. So he had been generative in his early stage of life because he had been a good mentor. But eventually, he had to retire also, later than usual, because he was 70 when he retired. But from being a famous physicist, the head of a great laboratory, he suddenly had a lot of free time. So what did he do? He figured that there was an interesting relationship between physics and cooking. He became interested in how to change the characteristics of raw food into cooked food. So he learned to be a gourmet cook. He went to France, he learned to be a cordon bleu cook. Then when he was 75 or 76, he published his first cookbook in Europe, which became a bestseller. Because he approached it with his kind of scientific training. It wasn't your usual cookbook. It was one that explained the physics and the chemistry behind the combination of food. Now, I tasted some of his cooking, and I can guarantee you it's very good. It doesn't taste like the food cooked by a scientist. But what made special his recipes is this kind of understanding of the basic chemistry of food. Now, since that first cookbook, he has published three more, and he's one of the most read cooks in Europe. This is just one example. I mean, you go from one very different realm to another. You have the chance now to learn new skills, and except for those elderly people who are physically incapacitated, and unfortunately, there are many of those. But normal aging does not mean that you are going to lose your skills. It means that you have given new opportunities, more time, fewer responsibilities. For many people, now is the time to really brush up on the kind of skills that they didn't have the time, the energy to learn before. So whether we like it or not, everything inside us and around us is in constant change. Our bodies get stronger for a while and then they grow weaker. The expectations others have of us go steadily higher and then they decline. Sexual desires burst into fire when we are teenagers and then burn with an ever gentler flame to the end of our days. What we enjoyed doing when we were 10-year-olds may be embarrassing a few years later. On the other hand, every year something that we could not even understand when we were younger might give us unexpected joy. Flow is not granted to us once and for all. If we wish to enjoy life to its end, we must constantly take on new challenges and relinquish old ones, learn new skills, and give up the ones we already have. Each season of our life has its own peculiar taste, its unique sources of joy. If we discover what these are as we move along with the years, we will not end up like Ivan Illich, bemoaning the dreary waste of potentially wonderful existence.
Lucio, a 22-year-old whose motorcycle accident left him paralyzed below the waist, remembers.
When I became paraplegic, it was like being born again. I had to learn from scratch everything I used to know, but in a different way. I had to learn to dress myself, to use my head better. I had to become part of the environment and use it without trying to control it. It took commitment, willpower, and patience. As far as the future is concerned, I hope to keep improving, to keep breaking through the limitations of my handicap. Everybody must have a purpose. After becoming paraplegic, these improvements have become my life goal.
One purpose for achieving the flow state is to create happiness even in times of hardship. On this side, you'll learn how using flow can turn stressful experiences into strengthening ones.
If everything goes well with you, having flow may not be such a problem. But what if some sudden tragedy strikes? If you lose your health, your money, or the comforts of your home? Conditions of duress put the ability to be happy to a severe test. Yet, it is clear that people who learn to build flow in their lives, people who have an autotelic personality, are able to weather the storms and stresses of life. Now we will talk a little bit about how individuals confronted by great personal tragedies were able to transform the negative situation into a tolerable one and often ended up enjoying their lives more afterwards instead of letting tragedy destroy them. I'm talking here specifically about a group of people studied by one of my colleagues in Europe, Professor Massimini in Milan, who has focused particularly on people who had lost their sight